Okay, very good. So for this evening's Dhamma talk, it's on the theme of the sacred and the profane. And I thought I might begin by using my phone, being a typically profane object. Actually, I'll just give you a bit of a background to this. Some of you have been coming for some time to the talks will know that in the past I've occasionally given readings from the Pali Suttas. And so again, let's just give a bit of background. In Buddhism, we have a very strong and very important scriptural collection, like most religions. And for me, the suttas, which is the actual earliest record that we have of the Buddha's teachings, has always been my main inspiration, the main thing which has drawn me into Buddhism, of course, as well as a meditation practice. And I'm always a little bit disappointed that the suttas or Buddhist scriptures are not better known in Buddhism. And this is, I think, true both in traditional Buddhism and also in new forms of Buddhism, like we find in Australia. And I remember when I grew up as in Perth, I grew up as in a Catholic family, and we would go to church every Sunday, and the priest would, of course, there'd always be some readings from the Bible. And you know, what I kind of realized after that was that, you know, even if you actually sleep through most of those readings and don't pay attention or whatever, but still, if they happen regularly every week, then, you know, they go through a cycle. And then after a few years of going regularly, you actually have a reasonable knowledge of most of the things or many of the things that's found in the Bible. And, you know, I still have that and I still value that very much. I think it's a very good tradition. And there's nothing kind of like that in Buddhism. We tend to do some chanting where we might recite some traditional passages, but only a very, very small selection. And most of the scriptures which are found, most of the time we really don't know anything about. So I've had this idea to bring some readings of the suttas back into on a regular basis into my teachings here on a Friday night. Unfortunately, as I'm chronically disorganized, I usually forget to bring the book that has the suttas in there so I can do the reading. So occasionally I'll bring it and then I'll forget for a while and so on. So recently I got a new phone, and on the phone I've got an app that has many of the suttas on there. So that's Access to Insight. So if any of you have an Android phone, you can get that from the Android App Store. And even though it's not perfect by any means, it's not complete and so on, but still has a wide range of early Buddhist scriptures on there. So I wanted to give a reading using this, and partly in a way it's to show that actually these things are available, yeah, that phones are not just profane devices, but they're also can be used for sacred purposes as well. Yeah? So I'll do a short reading before we start, and this reading is from the Anguttara Nikaya, one of the collections. Early collections of early Buddhist scriptures, and this is Anguttara Nikaya number 3.34, the Hataka Sutta. Now, this is translated by Venerable Tanisaro. One of the problems we have in Buddhism is that there's not necessarily a great variety of translations of our scriptures, and the translations which are there are not necessarily ideal. So as we go through, I might improvise a little bit and change the translation to somewhat. So on one occasion, the Buddha was staying near Alavi on a spread of leaves by a cattle track in a Singsapa forest. Then Hataka of Alavi, out roaming and rambling for exercise, saw the Buddha sitting on a spread of leaves by the cattle track in the Singsapa forest. On seeing him, he went to him, and on arrival, having bowed down to him, he sat to one side. And sitting there, he said to the Blessed One, "I hope that the Buddha has slept in ease." And the Buddha replied, "Yes, young man, I have slept in ease. Of those of the world who sleep in ease, I am one." I always really like that, isn't it? Buddha's one of the people in the world who sleeps happily. And then Hataka said to him, "But Lord Buddha, the winter's night is cold. And this time is the season of frost and snowfall. Hard is the ground trampled by the hooves of cattle. Thin is the spread of leaves. Sparse are the leaves in the trees. Thin are your ochre robes. And cold blows the wind. Yet still, the Blessed One says, I have slept happily. Of those in the world who sleep happily, I am one. And the Buddha replied, in that case, young man, I'll question you in return. Answer as you see fit. Now, what do you think? Suppose a householder or a householder's son has a house with a gabled roof, plastered inside and out, draft-free, with a close-fitting door and windows shut against the wind. Inside he has a horsehair couch spread with a long fleeced coverlet, a white wool coverlet with expensive rugs and hide and made of deer hide, with a canopy above and red cushions on either side. And there a lamp would be burning, and his four wives, with their many charms, would be attending to him. Would he sleep happily or not? Or how does this strike you? And Hataka, the young man, said, yes, but this Lord, he would indeed sleep in ease. Of those in the world who sleep happily, he would be one. What do you think, young man? Might there arise in that householder some disturbance born of greed, hatred, or delusion, so that he might sleep miserably? And Hataka replied, yes, it's true. And the Buddha said, as for those disturbances which are born of greed, hatred, and delusion, burned by which that householder might sleep miserably, though greed, hatred, and delusion has been abandoned by the Buddha, by the Tathagata, its roots destroyed, made like a palm tree stump, deprived of the conditions of development and not destined to arise again in the future. This is why the Buddha always sleeps happily. And then the Buddha, the sutta ends with a summary verse. And the verse says, always, always he sleeps happily. The Brahman who is totally freed, who doesn't adhere to sensual pleasures, who's without acquisitions and cooled and having cut all ties and subdued fear in his heart, calmed, he sleeps happily, having reached the peace of awareness. So this is a little sutta on how to get a good night's sleep. Yeah? Very true, isn't it? Yeah? I mean, these days, that kind of luxury which the Buddha was painting, you know, we all have that. Okay, maybe we don't have the four wives to look after us, but all the rest of us, we have, right? And we have the nice place shielded from draft and a nice, soft, comfortable bed and all of those things. But still, so many people, where you need to take a pill to get a decent night's sleep. Yeah? Why is that? Well, because you're burning with the fevers of greed, hate, and delusion. Because that sense of peace is not found within, inside. So, and I think this is a good place to start with for talking about this topic of the sacred and the profane, because this is showing, I think, a very important way in which these things link up with each other. Yeah? That even though we think of them as separate, and sometimes even realms which are in conflict, then actually they should be realms which work together, which should support each other. And the overwhelming message that we find in the Buddhist teachings is that these two different aspects of life are both important and both part of our spiritual development, and that if they're nurtured and developed properly with wisdom, with care, then they will help and support each other. So we don't see these things as being conflicted. So, how to get a good night's sleep? You know, one time when I was in staying in Malaysia, I stayed for a year in a monastery there in a cave, and I used to go out every morning for alms round to the village. Yeah, so this is for a monastic. This is that intersection between the sacred and the profane. Right, I'm there in a cave. I'm hidden away. I'm like, world, go away. I don't want to see you. And I sit there and do my nice meditation and stuff. And then in the morning, you come out and you go into the village. And into the market. So one time I was in the market, I was coming back, and this Indian woman came up to me and said that she had a problem with sleeping, and she was having bad dreams, so she was afraid to go to sleep. So I said, okay, well, why don't you come to the temple and we can talk about it. So she came to the temple, and she said, I want you to do some chanting to make my bad dreams go away. So I said, okay, I'm happy to do some chanting for you. That's not a problem. And I said, but, you know, maybe you want to think about, you know, why are you having these bad dreams? You know, what are you having, some kind of emotional upset? Or sometimes it can be a simple thing. Maybe if you're eating heavy, rich food before you go to sleep or something, that can cause dreams. Or is there some kind of disturbance? Maybe you could try doing some meditation. If you do some loving kindness meditation, even for a few minutes before you go to sleep, then that can help you to have a good night's sleep. So, of course, I'm thinking about the advice in the Buddha in the Hatha Sutta. Yeah? If you don't have greed, hatred, and delusion, then you'll sleep well. And she just kind of looked at me puzzled and said, no, you do some chanting and make my bad dreams go away. Okay, I'll give up. I'll do some chanting. I don't know if the bad dreams go away or not, but she was happy. So, for me, one of the most crucial aspects of the Buddha's teaching is that it always calls on us to take responsibility for our own life, for our own choices and our own spiritual development, spiritual direction. The Buddha has said that it's not possible for him to bring somebody across the flood, but we need to cross the flood through our own efforts. Viriyena dukkhamacchayati is by means of making your own effort that one crosses over suffering. So, if I compare my experience with Buddhism with, say, my experience in my upbringing in the Catholic Church, I had a very sort of, I guess, a somewhat conventional Catholic upbringing. I went to a Catholic school and so on, and, you know, we'd go to Mass every Sunday, and, you know, you have the communion, and you don't really kind of know what you're doing. You kind of go there and sit because you're expected to, and the priest talks about something and you don't really listen, and then you go up. I don't have any complaints. It was quite nice, and some of the hymns were quite okay. But there's a... And, you know, I'm sure it would have meant more to me if I'd been older. Then I would have been able to understand things better. But there definitely was a feeling, and I think this is something which is not just a random thing, but I think it's quite inherent in the Catholic Church in particular, that there's something about that ritual which is very special. Yeah, so you actually have the ritual of communion, and it's through that you have the redemptive power which is brought there through the grace that's offered through the Church. So there's very much a sense that there's an external power, and the Church is there to mediate that, and that salvation really is only possible through that. Now, in Buddhism, we don't really think about things in that same way. The Buddha always said that one should rely on one's own efforts, that the Buddha can't save you. It's one's own efforts. It's through one's own actions and choices that lead you to suffering, and through your own actions and choices that lead you to happiness. So, how this works out is, how this applies in that, considering these notions of the sacred and the profane, is I think something like this. As we live, as we make our choices every day, we are choosing through how we pay attention, but by how we speak, what acts we choose to do, we are helping to create that world that we're living in. And that world that we're living in itself isn't either sacred or profane. The world is just as it is. These notions of sacred and profane are human notions. Yeah? And so we can bring a sanctity into the world wherever we want, if we choose to. Yeah? And I believe that in some sense, the further that one develops in the spiritual path, that the less rigid and the less black and white this distinction becomes. I think in the beginning we make a fairly clear distinction, and as time goes on, we gradually let that distinction go. Why do we make the distinction? Now, here's the important thing, and something which I don't think we think about often. When we mean the sacred, okay, what actually is the sacred? And this is a category. Sacred and profane is a category that's used in anthropology and so on. And you find it in probably just about every culture, that there's some realm which is considered the sacred or the taboo. And something which is sacred or taboo always has some kind of power. Right? In Indian thought, that what was sacred is ultimately what's called Brahman. Yeah? And this is like a sacred force. It's like a life force or the spiritual force of the cosmos. And so Brahman has a sort of power to it. And that power can be terrifying. And that power can be completely debilitating, and that power can tear the roof off your world. Yeah? So it has to be contained. Right? Just think about this. Like we tend to think about it that the world is something that's very powerful, right? And that we have to battle to save a little corner of sacred space somewhere in the corner, you know, so we can keep a little church in the corner or a little shrine in our room or a little 5 minutes to do some meditation. So we have to sort of battle to hold the profane out and keep a corner of our world to be sacred. Yeah? But what I'm suggesting is that we think about it the other way. We can think about it that this, what is sacred is what has real power. Yeah? And that the purpose of all of these, the churches and the doctrines and the dogmas and so on, is to contain what is sacred, because otherwise it's going to take over everything. And that is extremely dangerous. If that happens,
you become a monk.
Yeah, well, that's right. And that's why we have to keep a lid on it, right? Because if everybody becomes monks and nuns, then who's going to feed us, right? You know, sometimes people say that, you know, like what would happen if monastics are just parasites, what would happen if everyone became a monastic? I reckon it'd be great. Have you ever thought about that?
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be fantastic if everybody in the world...
Can you solve the greenhouse problem? Maybe?
Greenhouse problem, AIDS,
population.
Yeah, you can imagine what a way to go, actually, for the human race. Everybody just goes out in the forest and meditates until they die, yeah? It would be terrific, yeah. And imagine then, and sometime in the future, an alien race comes and lands on the earth and they see all these people sitting in meditation, the corpses in the forest. They think, who were these people?
Maybe that's what happened to the dinosaurs. They just all just went out and
Uh-huh. Yeah. Stranger things have happened. No, they haven't. But anyway, that's one option, yeah. You know, we could also, I mean, there are other ways we could go. I mean, imagine what would happen if everybody on Earth decided to become a hairdresser. Be terrible, wouldn't it? Yeah. The ozone layer would be destroyed from all the hair products. So, of course, the reality is the world isn't like that, right? The world is very complicated and people do all kinds of different things, right? But come back to this point, that the sacred is something which is very powerful and which needs to be contained. And this is actually a point which Carl Jung made, and one of, I think, his most powerful insights, one that really struck me in reading his work. He said that the purpose of churches, buildings, doctrines, dogmas, rituals, symbols, is to protect the religious practitioner from an experience of the divine. We think that these things are to bring you in contact with the divine, that they're supposed to raise you up. But he's saying that these are all in order to control the divine, to keep it under control. Because otherwise, it's just too dangerous. Yeah? There's too much energy. So we could think of, when I was growing up in the Catholic Church, we talked about the church as being a house for God. But you think about it, why does God need a house? Right? God's quite happy. He doesn't need a house. He can make his own house if he wants one. The church is, another way of looking at it. I'm not saying this is an absolute way of looking at it. I'm just saying this is a different way of looking at it that can open up another perspective. Another way of looking at it is to think of a church or a temple as being a prison for God. Yeah? And it keeps God under control. Yeah? Stops him being there and stops him from messing around when you leave the thing. Or within Buddhism, So we have all the pagodas, right? So in Buddhism, you know, one of the main things which in Buddhist, whenever you build a Buddhist temple or something, then you build a big stupa or a big pagoda, and inside that pagoda you put some Buddha relics. Yeah, so a little relic of the Buddha or relic of a saint or something like that. So you could, we normally think of that as being a memorial. So we use that to remember and to remind ourselves of the Dhamma and so on. But you can also think of it as the other way around, that these little pieces of the sacred are so powerful that we need to build this big stupa and put all these rocks on them to keep them down. Yeah? Because if we don't, who knows what they could do? Yeah? Who knows what power they could have? So again, I'm not trying to say this is the right way of looking at it. I'm just trying to say that there are different perspectives. So we shouldn't think of the sacred as being something which is very rare or very special. Actually, things which are sacred are things which are around us all the time. Yeah? And the world is actually imbued with those things. But we create in our human culture, we create these special categories of the sacred and the profane in order to give structure and organize our life. Right? So, one of the things which characterizes modernity is the sort of breaking down of those barriers. Yeah, there's not so much distinction between the sacred and the profane anymore. So, for example, an obvious example of that is the decline of monastic orders, especially in the West. That you see that the almost all in Christianity, almost everybody who teaches these days is lay people. Yeah, there's only very few monastic left, and a very similar movement in Buddhism, where there's a strong emergence of this lay teachers, rather than in the past it would have been almost entirely monastic teachers in Buddhism. So there's this movement towards breaking down those barriers and towards saying that we can practice, we can bring that sense of the sacred into everything that we do in our lives. Yeah? And of course that's true, right? You can bring a sense of sanctity into everything that you do in your life. Every time you interact with somebody, yeah? Every time I was driving down on the freeway with Alex today and some guy honked us from behind and Alex is like, oh, what's he getting so angry about? And I said, maybe he's not angry, maybe he's just expressing his joy. Enjoy that. Why not? Yeah? But that's just perception, isn't it? Yeah. So you can change these perceptions of how you're doing all the time. Every moment you have that choice in how you perceive things. Yeah. And that actually, for me, that's a very powerful thing. Once you learn that and once you know that, then you can bring a sense of the sacred into everything. Yeah. You walk down the street. Just look at the goodness in people's hearts. Right? Sounds like something very simple, but have you ever done it? Have you just walked down the street and then every person that you meet, do you think to yourself, there's goodness in that person's heart? Yeah? That's a very, very powerful reflection. Yeah? And once you do that, you start to realize that you're actually surrounded by things that are sacred all the time. Yeah? And so we're starting to learn to bring that power of the sacred into the profane world. So, if we're thinking about this more conventional model, more traditional model, where the sacred and the profane are separated, and you know, very often that separation is a very powerful thing, and even though in Australia, of course, a very secularized society, so we don't tend to see it so much, but I experienced it when I was in, especially in Thailand and especially in northeast Thailand, because it's still a very traditional Buddhist culture, and those notions of sanctity and so on are still very much felt. Right? It's not even so much an idea, it's just a feeling. Yeah? And the way that people would treat the monks, yeah, with incredible reverence and respect and so on. I mean, from my conditioning as an Australian, I found it extraordinary. So kind of very strange, you know. I mean, I could accept it because I'm in a different country and I just accept what people are doing, you know. It's not my place to come here and tell them what they should do or whatever, but it's a very different way of relating to between people. And it's felt like an energy. It's a palpable kind of sense of energy there, which is created by that separation, the sacred and the profane. So the positive side of that, you know, I don't think that either separating these things or bringing them together is good or bad in and of itself. I think these are both just different ways that cultures deal with these ideas. But the strength of that is that when you can clearly make that distinction, then what it does is it gives you a confidence to really give yourself over when you come into that sacred space, when you come into the temple or the monastery, when you come into that period of time when you're doing your meditation or when you're doing a retreat. You because you have that clear boundary and separation from your profane life, you can give yourself over to that 100%. Right? You can throw yourself in there because you know that it's safe because it has those boundaries. Yeah? And this, again, this is something which I experienced very, very strongly myself when I was practicing in Thailand. And sometimes in meditation, you experience everything. You're crying or incredible pain or anger or different kinds of physical reactions and all these kinds of things that can happen. And it's all okay. I know I had many, many strange things happen to me in my meditation, many of them. But I never worried about any of them because they were contained within the meditation. At the end of it, I could say, okay, cool, what was that about? I say, all right, go off and have a walk or have a cup of tea or something like that, or just have a break and then come back. It has a container, and that container keeps it safe. Yeah? And because it's safe, we can then allow that strength to fully express itself. And so this is why we find in those environments where there's a strong distinction between the sacred and the profane, that the sacred can actually express itself in very powerful ways. Yeah? And, you know, you think about it, you think in traditional cultures, say within Buddhist cultures, the powerful devotion, the powerful efforts that people make to learn and study the scriptures, yeah? The incredible devotional energy, meditation energy that people can bring to it. And that's caused by that separation, or supported by that separation between the sacred and the profane. So we should be a little bit careful or cautious when we're talking about then bringing that into the secular world, right? Of course, the disadvantage of that separation, right, is that all too often Buddhist practice becomes, or spiritual practice generally, but talking within the context of Buddhism, the problem with it is that it becomes something which only happens in the temple, right? So you can go along, you can do the worship, offer some flowers at the shrine or something, and then you walk out the door and you leave everything behind, right? And you can keep on going and doing whatever you like outside, but it's like, it's just there, yeah? And I think that happens in all spiritual traditions. So this is the disadvantage. So then, in modern times, we come along and we have this idea, okay, let's open the doors of the temple. Let's erase these boundaries and let's bring our sense of sacred into our profane life, yeah? And of course, that's not just a modern idea. We find plenty of precedents for it in Buddhist teachings and scriptures. There's a Taoist saying, it was before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. Yeah. So this kind of idea is a similar kind of thing, that we're not separating. And so we can do that. We can say, well, we don't need a separate place to have a temple. We don't need a special time to set apart to do our Buddhist practices, because I can be mindful wherever I am. I can practice kindness with whoever I'm with. I can meditate while I'm in any situation. And so we have this idea, but of course that's all good, right? Doing all of those things is good, but what tends to happen is that the strength of it all becomes much weakened. Yeah? It doesn't have that same energy. And it's actually the separation which actually creates the energy. Yeah? So what we tend to find in more secularized forms of spirituality, where there's no, say, separate, say, religious specialists, like a monastic order or priest order or something like that, where there's no separate religious space, there's no temples and so on, we tend to find that spirituality has a certain flatness to it, that there's a kind of the energy goes out of things, yeah? And this is something I also observed in my time as a Catholic, and in the modern Christianity, I think that's very much characteristic, that there's a sort of a depletion of the spiritual energy that comes when things become brought into this touch with the secular world. And I think we find the same thing within Buddhism, that the idea of bringing mindfulness into our daily activities, of course, is a good thing, but there tends to be a shallowing of the teachings, that teachings tend to become more of a therapy, that the goal of teachings becomes to get a bit more peaceful or to alleviate stress rather than to become enlightened, for example. And again, I'm not saying these things are bad, and I'm not saying that one thing is worse than the other. I'm just saying that we should be conscious of that taking these different approaches tends to lead to these different kind of results, that's all. So for myself, when I first practiced Buddhism, first I went to a meditation retreat in Thailand, and I did a very intensive retreat for 1 month in Chiang Mai. And after that, I sort of came out, and I was like, well, okay, now I've done this retreat thing, I can meditate. Now I've got to try to live. What's that all about? So I had a very, very interesting experience, because what happened was I was in Thailand. I had very little money. I was a musician. They're almost synonyms, those two words. And I'd gone to Thailand. I had $1,000, and I was planning to stay in Thailand for a year. Right? Now, before I'd done my retreat, I'd tried to get work playing in, you know, bars and so on in Chiang Mai. No one would give me a job. And then I did this retreat. Came out of the retreat. I went back to the guest house that I'd been staying in, and the owners of the guest house said to me, "We want to adopt you as our son in Thailand." This was an Irish woman and a Thai husband. And they ran this very nice guest house it's called the Eagle House. Hi, Pon and Annette, if you're watching this. I've still kept in touch with them occasionally. The Eagle House, if you're ever in Chiang Mai, it's a great guest house. Add over. And they do sort of eco-friendly tours and treks, and they work closely with hill tribes people and so on and so forth. So they really do a lovely job. And they said to me, you know, you can stay here as long as you like. You don't have to pay anything to stay here. You don't have to pay for food. And the husband had gone to school with the guys from a band called Karawan, which is probably the second biggest rock band in Thailand. They're kind of like the Bob Dylan of Thailand. but good, yeah, if you look at their stuff, it's good. And so he knew people who ran the pubs and so on around the place, who said, "We'll get you work playing music." So I used to go around from one place to the other and play guitar in these different restaurants and pubs, sometimes up to three places a night, do that. And then in the daytime I'd teach English and then go to the temple to study Abhidhamma in the temple and try to keep up my meditation and so on. And so it was really kind of an experience of mixing very much the sacred and the profane, yeah, going from the temple to the pub at night. And it was all right. It was good. But, you know, after a while you realize I didn't have that much in common with all the people that I was meeting in the pub, you know. And one thing which I really noticed and which really struck me was that how all these people that I was meeting, they have no idea of no idea of who they are. They have no idea of that to be able to reflect on their thoughts. You just have a thought or have an idea, and it just sort of comes out. And it's from this retreat, it was just so apparent to me that everything that I could think or feel or whatever, you have a certain understanding of it. You have a certain perspective, a context, and you understand, well, this is just a thought, this is just a feeling, this is just an idea. And I was really struck by how everyone was just sort of going along, following their own thoughts, following their own ideas without any reflection. And so I did this for a while, and it was kind of okay, but I didn't find it to be very inspiring, not for me. I didn't find a path there. So I sort of wandered around the place and did a few different things before I ended up in the monastery. And it's very clear to me that that's what I wanted to do. That's how I wanted to proceed from there. So, I'm not really a very good person to talk about this topic, because I actually kind of failed to integrate the sacred and the profane. So, I kind of got a bit of a bias there. And I certainly don't believe and don't suggest that, you know, the path that I've chosen, the monastic path, I don't think that's the path for everyone. I don't think that should be, and I don't think it's necessarily best for everyone. I think it's best for people if they feel that calling. Yeah, and it's something I felt a calling for. But I kind of think that that's somehow fairly rare. The critical thing, though, is not whether you're monastic or lay or any of those kinds of things. The critical thing is our ability to listen to our inner voice, listen to our sense of intuition, and to know what is the right thing to do. If we have the big direction right, if we have that purpose, that sense of purpose, then all of those little questions about this tension between the sacred and the profane, this tension will resolve itself. Yeah, I really think that the root of these things, and why so many people struggle with it, because I think we're struggling with the symptoms. We're struggling to work out, you know, how much time do I spend watching telly and how much time do I spend doing meditation, you know, and these kind of surface questions. Whereas what's really important is the underlying question, like how are we living our life? What are the values that we're bringing into the choices and what we're doing with our lives? And if that is sorted out, and if we have that confidence and that faith that what we are doing is the right thing for us to be doing, that we are living our life, as we say in Buddhism, in accordance with the Dhamma. There's a beautiful phrase that uses in Pali, Dhamma anu Dhammang Patipati, is the practice of Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. So Dhamma, in one sense, means the Buddha's teachings and the Buddha's practice, but also it means just nature or how things are. So it means living or practicing one's life in accordance with the truth. Yeah, living in a way that actually goes along with the truth, goes along with what is good, goes along with the Dhamma, and not fighting it or being dragged against it. So if we have that sense of vocation, that sense of that here we're doing something that's really valuable, that's calling us in that higher direction, then all of those little details will fall into place. Yeah? And we won't worry about those things so much. At its highest sense, of course, the distinction between the sacred and the profane fades away. Actually, you know, that those things are not real things, they're not things that exist objectively in the world, they're just ideas which people bring to the world to help make more sense of it, to help cope. As our spiritual practice deepens, we don't have the need for those coping strategies anymore. And if we live our life in tune with the Dhamma, in tune with how things are, then we will live fully in the world, fully a part of the world, and relating to and dealing with or managing with all of the basic worldly profane things of the world perfectly well without any sense of conflict, while at the same time having a fully realized sense of transcendence or sense of a sense of, I guess, a higher purpose or something like that. In Buddhism, of course, ultimately we call this Nibbana. And in the sutta I read at the beginning of the class, or the beginning of the talk, I talked about the Buddha said that he sleeps well because he doesn't have greed, hatred and delusion in his heart. And of course the Buddha many times would define the absence of greed, hatred and delusion is what Nibbana is. Yeah? No greed, no hatred, no delusion. That's Nibbana. So this is how the Buddha gets a good night's sleep. Yeah? Become enlightened. Yeah, no greed, no hatred, no delusion. Yeah, and that's when that all those external conditions, the cold wind, the hard ground, the thin covers, well, they don't matter so much, yeah, if you don't have greed, hatred and delusion. So next time someone says they have trouble getting a good night's sleep, you just say, okay, just become a Buddha first and then you'll sleep well. Okay, so that's probably talking enough for this evening. I'd like to open up if anyone has any comments or questions.